We're glad to have you with us today. We'll be hearing four oral arguments on the docket. And we'll call the first case number 21-30474, United States of America versus John Weldon and Ariston Wilson. Ms. Kuhn, welcome. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Samantha Kuhn, and I represent Ariston Wilson in this appeal. With the court's permission, I'd like to focus on the two evidentiary issues related to Mr. Wilson during argument, but of course, I'm happy to answer questions about the other issues at any point. Starting with the Rule 404B error, because that was critical error in this case, especially in a trial where the evidence against Mr. Wilson was already so thin. The district court allowed the testimony to come in about an uncharged robbery from 3 months after the charged offenses that Mr. Wilson was involved in. And the district court admitted it for both identity and intent purposes, but both of those admissions were error. Starting with identity, clear precedent in this court dictates that for something to be admissible as extrinsic proof of identity or MO, it needs to be so similar to the charged offense that it has a signature quality, that it marks the handiwork of the accused. And it needs that distinctiveness because the whole point of 404B is to prevent juries from making conclusions based on the character or propensity of a defendant to commit a crime. And if a jury were allowed to conclude simply because somebody committed another robbery that they were more likely to have committed the charged offense, that would be an improper inference. And that's why identity evidence is required to be so similar and so distinctive. In this case, the government hasn't disputed that the only similarities tying the charged offenses and the uncharged conduct is our generic common features of most armed robberies. It was armed men wearing masks and gloves who robbed a gas station and stole money. And those are generic features, not only under according to the government and according to the defense, but also according to this court in Myers. In Myers, this court found that those were generic features common to most robberies that could not create the sufficient distinctiveness in order for the evidence to be admissible for identity purposes. And in Myers, in fact, the court said that even in combination, and even in combination with other similarities that don't exist here, that was not sufficient. And so I think that case, as well as the Carrillo case from this court, where it was a drug offenses and there was an extrinsic drug buy that was in the same drug-ridden neighborhood, the court said that that was not sufficiently similar, even though the offenses occurred in the same area. And so that ends the inquiry with respect to the identity issue. That should not have been admitted to prove MO or identity in this case. Then shifting to the intent issue.
Can I stop you there for one second? The geographic proximity or not of these, what is your position on that? I forget how many, seven crimes that are the charged crimes here, or the crimes under the indictment. This extrinsic one, where was it, and in your view, does the proximity or not help or hurt your argument here?
I think the proximity actually helps the argument here. In this case—
Well, where was it, I guess, first?
So the extrinsic offense was in the New Orleans East area, whereas all of the charged offenses occurred on the West Bank area of New Orleans.
How far is that? I'm from Baton Rouge.
I believe it's about 7 miles.
So 7 miles, okay. So
opposite sides
far?
Of the city.
Yeah.
I would say, relatively speaking, especially when you're trying to create a signature quality, I think if you look at all of the charged offenses, for example, if they're all occurring in the same neighborhood, presumably that could be a feature. You say, okay, well, these are all in the same area. Maybe that is some kind of similarity that goes to it. This was the opposite side of town. And then I think also Carrillo is instructive here, because in Carrillo, the charged offense was a drug distribution, and the uncharged conduct was other drug distributions in the same exact neighborhood, not even the same city, but the same neighborhood. And the court found that just simply the fact that there were other drug buys in the neighborhood where heroin was sold in balloons in the same format, the same general, structure of a drug sale, that is not sufficiently distinct, I guess, to make it relevant for identity purposes. So I think here you don't even really get to the geographic proximity because that is not a distinctive quality. But I think if you were to look at it, it actually weighs in favor of the defense because it is so far relative to the cluster of robberies that occurred in the charged offenses.
Okay, and so as far as identity, I don't know if you're saying this, the case you point to is Myers. That's the strongest, you think that's the strongest case that that shows this evidence shouldn't have been admitted under 404B?
Yes, I think Myers and Carrillo.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. And then shifting to intent, when we look at intent, the district court also erred for this admission. Starting off with the fact of relevancy, as this court held in Beecham, relevance is based on what the evidence is submitted to prove, what it is provided as evidence of. And here, the government at no point tried to provide this evidence as proof of Mr. Wilson's intent to join a conspiracy with John Weldon 3 months prior to commit other robberies. That was never argued, that was never presented for that purpose. And so it had no relevance to the intent element. But that being said, this court doesn't even need to parse out whether it might have bore some kind of relevance because it clearly fails under Beecham's prong two, under the balancing act between probative value and risk of undue prejudice. Under this court's precedent, when you look at that balancing test, the first factor you look at is the government's need for the evidence when you're analyzing probative value and prejudice. And here, the government had no need. This is analogous to the Jackson case, where the central issue in the case was identity. Was Mr. Wilson one of the people depicted in the surveillance footage of the robberies? Once the jury made that conclusion, there was no question that the intent was found, because as the government argued in closing, clearly these two individuals worked together to commit the robberies. The government, in fact, treated this as kind of a disposable element in its closing, saying, that's set aside, conspiracy is an agreement, clearly there's an agreement, let's move on to the evidence that they actually committed this crime. And so here, once you get to prong two, under Jackson, this clearly requires reversal because the probative value couldn't possibly provide any, I guess, value to the jury in assessing the intent element. It was inconsequential and negligible at most. And on the other hand, there was a significant high risk of prejudice from this evidence, which was the clearest indication that Mr. Wilson committed any robbery. This was essentially a caught red-handed moment where they explained how they tracked a car from the robbery, saw him get out of the car, went into the apartment where the individuals went into, and found him in there where there was a rifle, which is also a distinction from the other charged robberies, and money and all of these other elements. And so this was the most damning, incriminating evidence to suggest that Mr. Wilson committed any robbery. And then in closing, the government used that to say it was simply unbelievable that he didn't commit the charged offenses when he was found in this closet hiding with money and a gun and all of these other elements, even injecting additional similarities that didn't exist to try to draw a thread between these.
What were the additional similarities that didn't exist in your view?
Primarily the blue gloves. The government said repeatedly in closing, I believe three times, that blue gloves were a common element that linked these two, the charged and uncharged robberies. And then I believe at one point they also said found in the same clothes, which it's unclear where that came from.
So it wasn't blue gloves in your view, it was gloves of some other color?
There was no evidence of the color of the gloves.
No evidence of the color.
Right. The testimony was only that they had face coverings and gloves. And so for all of those reasons, at the very least, if this court doesn't reverse the convictions on sufficiency grounds, Mr. Wilson is entitled to a new trial with that 404B evidence excluded. Now, with my remaining time, I was going to address the lay opinion testimony evidence issue. It does not appear from the briefing that the government disputes that this is not permissible testimony. The government has never argued that this was defensible or this should have been admitted. It only argues that this is not clear or obvious error. There does not need to be, as I think the government suggests, a clear case from this court on the exact fact pattern and scenario for this to be clear or obvious error. The standard is simply whether it's subject to reasonable dispute under the existing law. And based on Masha, where this court reviewed very similar testimony where somebody looked at a surveillance photo or video, identified the defendant, and provided that as lay opinion testimony, this court explicitly relied on the fact that the government had provided an adequate foundation for that, specifically that the person had lived in the BOP prison facility for 4 years with the defendant, had interacted with them 30 to 40 times, had personal familiarity. And that was the—
I want to make sure that I'm clear on this because the briefing is a little, I found to be a little vague. The identification that they make of the defendants, that the witness makes of the defendant, is part of the investigation prior to the charges being brought in this case? Or are you saying that at the trial or before the trial, as part of the trial prep, like an expert witness, the officer looked at the, or the investigator looked at the photographs or the video and said, well, that's the same person. Is it for trial purposes, or is it for, or is it part of the investigation where they're trying to identify people who were wearing masks on the video or the photographs?
I think it was presented as both. So it was presented in the context of asking the officers about how they came to identify Mr. Wilson as the other individual in their view in these surveillance photos. And so they explained that they did this photo comparison and determined that this was the individual.
But isn't that the whole reason why we have surveillance cameras in convenience stores and things of that nature, to record an image so that that image can be matched up and the person identified?
Sure, but I think the issue here is that that was the central factual question for the jury, to decide if that was, in fact, Mr. Wilson in that surveillance. And the officers testifying that they believed that was him and they could positively, confidently identify him in that photo, that added nothing to the jury's analysis because they had no basis, no, I guess, other basis to be more familiar with his appearance than the jury did. And in fact, that testimony went beyond just saying, oh, this was our investigation, we determined this was him from the photos, and that's why we arrested him. It went beyond that into identifying, from their view, almost as if an expert would, specific elements and saying that they looked at other photos and compared it, basically imputing this additional credibility, bolstering the own credibility of the officers in their explanation. And then beyond that, the officers did, I believe one officer did directly identify the defendant sitting at the table as the person he identified to be in the video or the photo. And then later, the officer even said, he testified that the eyewitness told him when he went to talk to him during the investigation that, yeah, that was definitely the eyes of Mr. Wilson, when in fact that witness testified that he did not know and could not identify from the photos. And so I think there's many elements that bolster the prejudice here.
Were there, I don't mean to interrupt you, I know you're running.
No worries.
Were there limiting instructions or some kind of instructions from the court to the jury with respect to the officer's testimony as to the photo?
No, the only limiting instructions with respect to opinion testimony were directed to expert testimony. Because I believe it was expert testimony about either the interstate commerce element or something else. There was no limiting instruction directed to the actual lay opinion testimony about the photographs, because it was not objected to at trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have time for rebuttal. Mr. Plaisance.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Plaisance, CJA attorney on behalf of Mr. Weldon. While my colleague did a phenomenal job in explaining to you why our clients, there's insufficient evidence to show that our clients committed the crime, I'd like to focus real quick on how do you get there. Because this is one of those rare cases, at least the first one I've ever found, where trial counsel failed to invoke Rule 29. In fact, both Rule 29. In fact, both counsel failed to do so. So according to the jurisprudence, which I would like to have this court examine, it says that you must find a manifest miscarriage of justice in order to reverse, rather than insufficient evidence under the Jackson standard, which to me is a much more easier burden for the government. Sorry if I say state because I'm in state court a lot, for the government, because according to the manifest miscarriage of justice rule, it says as long as they can point to any evidence in the record to sustain conviction, that's sufficient. That's not what Jackson calls for, and that's not what sufficient evidence calls for. It's certainly not what the jury was instructed. The jury was instructed that they must find the defendant's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And while the Delgado case, which was en banc, may limit, or you may feel limits, your ability to sway or move away from my argument, there is plenty of jurisprudence outlined in the briefs that say, how do you get to convince your colleagues to review their ruling en banc? In other words, you're not constrained to follow the rule merely because it's en banc. You can say, we recommend our colleagues review it because of this. And here's why. Again, like I said,
saying that in writing this opinion, we should encourage our colleagues to go en banc to change Delgado?
If necessary, yes. Okay. Yes. Because it's just not a fair decision. It's got some, obviously, at least one dissent was former Justice Dennis, but it just constrains the defendant so much, because if the government says, here's a piece of evidence, a cluster of robberies. Oh, that might be sufficient to confirm. But especially, you know, as my colleague pointed out, and I'll get right to my client in the last few minutes, you talked about surveillance, not one of the store individuals could identify Mr. Weldon as the robber. Not one of the surveillance videos could identify Mr. Weldon.
Mr. Lewis's testimony, isn't that enough to carry a conviction on your client?
He may have alluded to the fact that they committed the bank robbery, okay? But I don't recall where he alluded to the fact that they committed the other robberies. And as you notice, I'm parsing the two. I'm not forfeiting the bank robbery, but I'm parsing the two because I think that the evidence is less on the stores. And the only thing they found is a state probation officer said, who had seen him 8 times and said, I think it's him, looking at photographs, and did not even point to him in court. Couldn't say in court. That's Judge Duncan, who I've had on probation 8 times.
Well, thank you, Mr. Pleasance. You have some time for rebuttal. So.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Daly.
May it please the court, Kyle Daly for the government. And with the court's permission, I'd like to turn directly to Wilson's 404B argument. The government in this case noticed its intent to introduce 8 uncharged robberies by Wilson in the months after the charged robberies that he committed with Weldon. And in Wilson's pretrial filings, what he argued was that the uncharged robberies would be overly prejudicial. He didn't say that any issue
Could you speak a little louder? For some reason, this is not capturing every pearl that you're picking
forth. And so what he argued was that the uncharged robberies would be overly prejudicial, but he did not say that any issue was going to be uncontested, such as identity or intent. By the time we got to the trial, at the end of the government's presentation, the parties argued about whether one single of those 8 uncharged robberies ought to come in, and that was the last of the 8 uncharged robberies. And again, counsel does not say that intent or identity are going to be uncontested issues, and the judge admits the one uncharged robbery for purposes of both identity and intent. And it's another robbery of another New Orleans gas station convenience store with multiple individuals wearing gloves, masks, using handguns, and using a getaway car. Now, under Beecham, the analysis is in two steps, right? Whether the probative value of that robbery, or whether the robbery has some relevance to an issue other than character, and then whether the probative value is substantially outweighed by the risk of unfair.
Just so I can understand, you're saying that with respect to this uncharged robbery, maybe you're saying the other side did not argue that there was a problem with respect to identity or intent for introducing those. They only argued about prejudice? Is that what you're saying?
They only argued about prejudice before trial, and then their argument during trial was limited to, we don't think that this robbery is similar enough to come in.
Okay, so you're not saying that the way that this was argued below should affect our review of the 404B?
No, no. Okay. The reason I'm getting into that and the reason that it's important is because this court, since Roberts and many other times since that, citing Roberts, has said that under the Beecham, the first step of the analysis, whether an issue is relevant, in a conspiracy case, intent is always relevant. This court has said that over and over again. Conspiracy is charged here.
Before we get too far into that, what makes this piece of evidence, this particular robbery, so unique and so identifiable so as to link to one or both defendants? I think in just one of the defendants in this case. What makes this robbery stand out in that fashion? I mean, convenience stores get robbed by people in masks and with guns and getaway cars, unfortunately, very frequently, especially in New Orleans. Why is this one suitable for 404B?
So what this court said in Myers is that multiple common features together can be of high probative value. And so, yes, oftentimes armed robbers wear masks. Oftentimes they use handguns. Oftentimes they use getaway cars. But in this case, all of those are present, just like the charge robberies. And importantly, these are, in Myers, they were talking about robberies that happened in different states. I think it was Pennsylvania and Florida. So you have this large area of the country, and the issue is the likelihood that somebody else is committing these similar robberies. And when you have them, you know, just miles apart, as we recently discussed, that makes it much, the probative value is much higher, because the likelihood that it's somebody, it just happens to be somebody else, goes down significantly. So it's another gas station, convenience store, face coverings rather than, for instance, hats, gloves rather than ungloves, multiple robbers rather than a lone robber, cash rather than just property alone, getaway car rather than bike, motorcycle. So yes, all these things are rather common, but you put them all together, you put them in close geographic geographic space and close in time, we think that is enough for the district court to find that there's...
We heard that the geographic space was, I forget how many miles, but two different parts of New Orleans. What about the temporal proximity? How much time?
Months apart. I believe it was less than 4 months. I have yet to see a case, and the defense hasn't cited anywhere, this court found that a different area of town was not geographically close. And this, I guess you could call them different areas of town, but I wouldn't say that they were on the opposite sides of town. And New Orleans is a relatively small city. So this is a minute's drive away from all of these gas stations. It just so happens that five or so of the charge robberies all are, you know, practically walking distance from each other. Mm-hmm. So if there's a signature there, then you move to the second step of the analysis. And so what we're looking at is a number of factors. One, the necessity of the evidence, whether the uncharged robbery is similar, timing, and whether there are the limiting instructions given to the jury about this evidence. And before I move on to that, with the intent issue, what they're arguing is that the government's evidence basically took intent out of the relevancy determination because it was so strong. That's what they're arguing on appeal. But what this court has said under Roberts and other cases is that in order for it not to be relevant under step one, the defendant has to take that issue out. And so this court has said, you know, he can do that, for instance, by stipulating. So if counsel had stipulated to the government's intent, then that would have taken the intent issue out. But that's an element that we have to prove in every conspiracy case. So our argument is that satisfies that first step of the Beecham analysis. So then you move to the 403 analysis in step two. And this evidence was additional evidence that Wilson was one of those two robbers, and that he was a willing and active participant in these robberies. These robberies were very similar, even though the government didn't get out that the gloves were blue as it had intended to. These are the exact same crime. So this isn't like a Jackson situation where the government or where the district court admits a five-year-old conviction for stealing a couple of watches when the defendant is charged with expert jewelry thieves for stealing almost $1 million in jewelry and shipping them interstate. So these are very similar crimes. They're the exact same crime. The timing, also much better than in Jackson. We're not talking about a five-year-old conviction. We're talking about months. In Jackson, it's not entirely clear from the opinion whether jury instructions were given. The opinion does not say that the instructions were given. It mentions that instructions can reduce the prejudice, and that's what happened here. The district court gave limiting instructions both when the evidence was admitted and then at the end of the case as well. And this was not a mini trial. There were 10 different robberies that were discussed in this trial. So this was just one robbery, two witnesses, isolated at the end of the case, because the district court, as district courts often do, wanted to hear what the government's evidence was before determining whether or not to admit that 404B evidence. It wasn't particularly inflammatory because it's just one more of the same kind of crime. The jury has already heard about all these other robberies. So considering all of that, the district court did not abuse its discretion by admitting this for either identity or intent. Now, turning to the testimony about Wilson's eyes, there's nothing in the plain language of Rule 701 that prohibits an officer who studied surveillance photos during his investigation and studied pictures of a suspect from explaining to the jury that this comparison was part of my investigation and it led me to do other things. It was my opinion that these eyes matched, and so I decided to focus my investigation on this particular individual. And that's what happened in this case.
Now, do you agree that if we were looking to the law of other circuits on this issue, maybe not, I'm not sure how many circuits, but some other circuits would say you wouldn't admit testimony under 701, I think, unless the proponent of the testimony actually knew the person. So, I can tell, I've known this person in the past, so I can tell that these eyes are his eyes. Whereas that's not what's happening here, right? The officers didn't know this person outside the context of the investigation.
That's true. The case that we rely on is Maddox from the Sixth Circuit, which was a similar situation here, where the court found that it was important that the officer was not called for the purpose of identifying the defendant, but was explaining what he did during his investigation. But yes, if for instance, Detective Cockerham was called just for the purpose of looking at two photos and identifying Wilson as the robber, then yes, under most circuit precedent, that would be problematic.
And you'd say that was error. You wouldn't be arguing that that's permissible if that were the case.
I would be, that's correct. If okay. That's what the government did in this case, then that's correct. There was no objection, so there really wasn't much of a foundation laid. There's no indication that we can see from the record that Detective Cockerham had previous dealings with Mr. Wilson. Another factor that comes up in the case law is whether or not the appearance of the defendant has changed. We don't really know whether that was an issue or not. We don't know exactly what Wilson looked like in court, but there's no indication that his appearance changed. But this was part of him explaining why, what Wilson has noted at trial, and I think it was maybe the first statement or his first sentence in the statement of the case, I was never implicated by anybody. That's one of his arguments. And so the jury's... I was never implicated by anybody. No eyewitnesses identified me. They didn't get any tips. And so the jury is going to be left to wonder without testimony about this comparison, well, why did they pick Wilson out of everybody on earth to start investigating? Why are they looking for him? Why are they trying to track down his address? Why are they trying to talk to his brother? And so the detective is explaining, this is why. This comparison of these eyes was important to me, and that's why I did that.
And you're saying, just so I can understand your answer about other circuit precedent, you're saying that there's a Sixth Circuit case that supports the distinction that you're making here.
Yes.
Okay. And that's, what is that again?
Maddox. M-A-D-D-O-X.
Maddox. Okay.
Yeah. And even if the admission of this testimony could be considered to be plain error, or that the error was clear and obvious, then we move to prongs 3 and 4. And here, the government didn't use Detective Cockerham as some sort of expert in eye identification. It in a situation, for instance, where the government says, this detective has compared hundreds of surveillance photos to suspects, and he's just better suited than you, jury, to look at this evidence, maybe that would be problematic. But that's not what happened.
That would be error, I think. Right. Maybe even clear error if that's what the government did.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Perhaps. Yeah. But here, the government didn't even mention the eyes in its first closing argument. The defense, Wilson's counsel, made a big deal of the eyes in his closing argument, and what the government did in response was just pulled up both pictures. Jury, take a look at this. Now, Wilson's counsel, appellate counsel, is arguing, well, the government used the phrase same eyes, and I guess the suggestion is that triggered the jury to defer their comparison of these photos to one of the officers, because one of the officers said same eyes, but there's nothing distinctive about the phrase same eyes. And if you look throughout the transcript, Wilson's counsel makes the point on his cross-examination of the officers, you're not an expert in comparing eyes, and the officer says, no, I'm not. And the government doesn't dispute that. The government doesn't dispute that in closing arguments either. So this was there's no reason to believe that the jury just gave up its comparison and just believed Detective Cockerham because he said that he thought that the eyes were the same. Unless there are any other questions, we would ask that you affirm the convictions. As we've noted in our brief, there was an issue with Wilson's sentence and how the guidelines are calculated. So we agree that Wilson's sentence needs to be vacated.
Okay, do you have any response? Mr. Pleasant's making an argument about our precedent. What's your response to that?
My response is, if this court is going to consider upending decades of precedent about the standard of review, it ought to be maybe in a case where the issue is close and maybe it's a borderline case. But as Judge Engelhardt pointed out, in one of these convictions, his accomplice explained how the robbery happened. There was no alluding to it. He said, this is how the robbery happened. That was Weldon. There he is. He's robbing the bank. And then on the convenience store robbery.
Our panel can't upend precedent.
Right.
We're a panel.
Exactly. That's my argument.
All right.
Counsel, do you agree that we would not reach the Section 1B1.2 question on sentencing the guideline issue if we go ahead and vacate and remand? It seems like the government's in agreement that there needs to be a resentencing.
Yes, so I don't see any reason for the court to address that issue. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Kuhn.
Just briefly on the 404B issue, I just wanted to point out, I know the government just said that, I believe they said that we hadn't cited any cases on the geographic issue. I just wanted to redirect the court's attention to Carrillo. That was the case with, as I mentioned before, the drug offenses. And the court specifically said, in sum, the January 8th sale, the extrinsic sale, was a typical drug sale in a drug-ridden urban neighborhood where such transactions are commonplace. And so even in the same neighborhood, that was not deemed to be sufficiently similar. Also, with respect to the getaway car, I wanted to point out that, as the government notes in its brief, there's only two of the charge offenses where they even allege that there was a getaway car. But if you look at the surveillance of those, which is in evidence and in the record, there's no getaway car present at the scene at the actual place that's robbed. In particular, if you look at the Circle H surveillance video, you see two individuals walking from blocks away, and then they leave the same way running down the street. And the government claims that a car that drives by later is the getaway car and matches John Weldon's car. Whether that's true or not, I would argue that that is a distinction, not a similarity, between the uncharged offense where there was actually a getaway car present that drove up to the gas station and left from the same position. And then moving on to the lay opinion testimony, just briefly, I know Judge Duncan, you were asking about other circuits. Mm-hmm. Seven circuits, the 1st, 4th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, have all held that there has to be some basis for the person testifying about who is in a surveillance video or footage to conclude that they would be better able than the jury to make that assessment and make that identification. The Maddox case that the court mentioned that they said was, you know, arguably created a circuit split or something like that, I believe was unpublished, a Sixth Circuit case. And in that case, the person who was testifying, it was a police officer who had actually conducted a raid. It's unclear whether the defendant was present for that raid, but it suggested that potentially he did have some out-of-court interaction with the defendant. And in fact, in that case, the court explicitly said that their ruling was governed by Mansour, which was another Sixth Circuit case. And in that case, a security guard at a bank had seen the defendant casing the bank prior to the offense actually being committed. So in Mansour, there was a clear basis for that person being more familiar and seeing the defendant in the circumstances outside of the actual case or the comparisons the jury could do. So the Sixth Circuit relied on that and said that they were governed by that. Also, one last point, I wanted to note that in the government's closing, they did specifically identify the eyes, Mr. Wilson's eyes, allegedly, in that photo as the single unique feature. They talked about the tan boots being common and all these other elements, but otherwise they largely tried to lump him in with the evidence against John Weldon and then specifically pointed those eyes as being unique. So I think that heightens and shows why this lay opinion testimony was prejudicial.
Thank you. Mr. Pleasant, you have 60 seconds for rebuttal. Or a minute.
I think I can do it, Your Honor.
You can do it.
Three quick points. Regardless of whether you believe that you should try to convince your colleagues to change the standard of review or not, it's a miscarriage of justice to find Mr. Weldon guilty in this case. First of all, I'll point you to the fact that as I mentioned before, the government called his probation officer. And at record page 1039, he said, the identification of the picture you made, you said you're not 100% sure that's Mr. Weldon, correct? And he said, no, yes. I mean, essentially, it was not correct. The government sent him photographs. As regarding the Hobbs Act issue, which is important because, again, under miscarriage, you're going to point to any issue. The government called an FBI expert who said, in a leading question, so cigarettes are involved in interstate commerce? Yes. Nothing further than that. And finally, Your Honor, the last thing, Judge Engelhardt, Mr. Lewis's testimony regarding the things concerning the bank robberies and not the convenience store robberies, which I was focusing on
Thank
today.
Thank you, Mr. Pleasance. You're appointed, and we appreciate your service.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Good to see you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel. Case is under submission.